accession number 19855, Reel 2.
Jimmy Lee's a realtor.
Right. The death, the burial at sea didn't make much of an impression, but the memory of these men banging their spoons on the table and shouting, "Where's my bloody burgoo?" where their comrade of only a minutes earlier was dying in appalling state, his corpse dead, just feet away, did strike me as being odd. But again, the Bible, which I brought up, says, as I quote or misquote, "Let your business be with the living, not the dead." And that's quite true. It may be not the Bible saying it's true, but I think it is. Anyhow, we sailed on. Now, it always struck me that if 100 people or even 1,000 people are marooned on a ship or a desert island, one or two will end up owning the ship or the desert island or controlling all the others. Now, on the way into the ship at Liverpool docks, a man I saw ahead of me was carrying not only all his kit, but another kit bag on his back. And this intrigued me. I said, "What's in that thing?" He said, "You'll see, you'll see." And what he had in it were packed, jam-packed condoms, French letters, as we call them. Aboard the ship, there were nurses and ATS, there were women, missionaries and so on, and he was selling these things out at 5 shillings a time, and as I think the going rate was 3 for 2 and 6 pence from a chemist or a hairdresser, he was making a profit. And then another fellow saw him doing this, and he thought, "I'll make something out of it," and he went around the dark corners of the ship collecting the used ones and washed them and resold them. And they made a fortune. Another man took aboard 2 electric irons that fit plugged into, you know, the adapter plugs. And he rented these irons out to people who wanted to. We had to wash our own clothes, obviously, with no means of ironing anything. But some people were always very smart and military, beautiful press crease in their trousers and their shirt had a crease on the arm sides and the collars very smart, the khaki shirts we wore. And he made quite a thing. Anyhow, we landed at Cape Town. And for the first time, sorry, can I just go back?
Yes.
Before Cape Town, we stopped at Freetown. And we didn't, on the west coast, I don't know why we stopped, we just lay off the shore. And a barge, as it's called, an admiral's barge or something, came out with various naval officers who we had held in great respect. They're not our own officers, but we always assumed the Navy was something special. And on the front of this barge, there were 2 wrens, women's Royal Naval Service, women, girls, in trousers and blue jackets and hats and bare feet, and they had boat hooks which they rammed into the side of the ship to pull their thing, and their shouts of obscenities and "Get up there, Norb, it's your birthday," from the side of the troops, absolutely incredible. And these 2 girls, I've always remembered this, and when I see a woman now in late age, she says she was a wren, I tell them this thing. They didn't bat an eyelid or look up. They just treated all this with total disdain, which made an enormous impression on me. I don't know why, but it did. The sort of panache they had. Oblivious of all the obscenities and of signs and this and that being signaled to them. Anyhow, we landed eventually at Cape Town, and we were put up in a camp called Polsmore Camp, which before the war had been a racetrack, motor racetrack like Brooklands or Silverstone today, with huts for the cars and the pits for the mechanics and so on. And then after the war, it became a detention centre, I think, for various ANC people arrested during the apartheid days. Anyhow, we were there for 6 weeks, and it was quite an incredible time. Most of us had never been abroad before, and to see from the troop ship as we arrived, Table Mountain of enormous size, and on the top of the mountain, an absolute gigantic flagpole with a Union Jack flying, we suddenly realised what the Empire meant. It had never been just part of a music hall joke. People singing, I remember the music hall, with roast beef on Sundays and ants in our undies, the Empire depends on you. I was a maiden until I went to Aden, then I knew. Now we knew suddenly, we realised, people of every calibre and political persuasion, most of them left, what an amazing thing this had been. From this tiny island, people had gone out and settled in this vast, lovely, incredible country. And there was our flag. And we were there for 6 weeks. We had immense kindness shown by every sort of person to arrive in cars and take us out. Now, cars, I said, have always been my interest. And I was getting 9 shillings a day, I think, then, paid as an officer cadet, paid as a sergeant. But in a not unusual army situation, the money couldn't be found, or the cashier hadn't arrived, or the money hadn't arrived. So we were just literally down to our last few shillings. And I remember meeting a girl, when I was out in South Africa more recently, I actually looked up her name in the phone book, but of course she's probably a grandmother and everything else gone now. And we could either go to the beach at Muizenberg, which was Muizenberg, with a beautiful beach, or we could go to Cape Town on the train from Paulsmoor, and the stations were Deep River and Wynberg and one or two others. And there was a club there called the Blue Moon Club, which I'd never been to such a club. It was a very simple thing, really. It was a big, cheap restaurant with a blue ceiling, with lots of little lights or holes in the ceiling that looked like stars, you see. And you had a half pint of beer, or if you could afford it. I didn't drink, but I had something else, I suppose. I only went there once or twice. Anyhow, this girl wanted to go into Cape Town to the Blue Moon Club. Now, I realized I had a sort of, I think, 2 and 6 months in my pocket. I ran my thumbnail around the milled edge and realized I couldn't do that. But to try and dissuade her from this, there was a fair in operation. And I said, let's go and look at the fair. It was free, I think, and you had to pay to go to the stalls. And I would gravitate to the Wall of Death. Do you know what the Wall of Death is?
I do.
Which is a long, like an inside, huge wooden drum. And inside this, it's a vast size, well, yes, 100 feet across. You climb up stairs outside, so your head, you peer into this, and at the bottom in the center, you've got two motorcycles, usually with a man and a girl. In those days, they were dressed in sweaters and like riding breech jumpers. And they had Indians' motorcycles, two Indians, because they had two cylinders in case one packed in, and they'd go around the bottom, accelerate up, and go around the inside of this thing, and weave about. It was quite exciting, and they backfired, and it was quite simple, and for sixpence or something, and they coasted down. And he always said, as we cannot get any insurance this dangerous thing, we beg your indulgence, so we had to put in another sixpence. Now, a lot of soldiers around there, and I was standing, the girl wasn't very interested in this, and I realized I was going to have to say I had no money, and this was humiliating. Nowadays, you wouldn't bother. You'd say, I have no money. I'm sorry, I've run out, so we can go to the beach or go home. But then it was my ethos that one had to find some money to take this girl into Cape Town. And the bloke running the show down in the center, he looked up and saw a lot of soldiers over the top. He said, I'll give a quid. Any of you British soldiers will ride a motorbike right here. Pound note. That's it, lads. And I said, I'll do it. I'd never done this before, but I had a motorcycle, I had several. And I thought, there's not much in it, these people can do it. As long as you keep your speed up, centrifugal force keeps you the thing. And I went down there, and the smell down there was terrible, because carbon monoxide fumes to the exhaust, and the petrol is heavier than air, so the bottom is unbreathable down there. The top is quite hard. And the boat looked at me and he said, you sure you know what you're doing? And I said, give me the pound, I'll go. Well, he said, do it first, you get the pound. So I got astride this thing, kick-started it, and he said, gave it second gear and keep your speed up, otherwise you're dead meat. I said, thank you. So we get out in the bottom, boom, 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 boom. accelerate up and up round the side, then we're off. And I could hear dimly people cheering at the top. Now, it round and round the thing, weaves it up and down a bit because there's nothing in it once you're doing, then coasted to the bottom, got off, bowed to the public, and he got my pound. And the girl was delighted with this. And she said, let's go to the beach, and said, it's getting dark now, it's marvellous on the beach because the sand is phosphorescent. Now, I didn't realise this was an invitation for anything more than to look at the sand, which that's all I did. And I must say, I've often thought of that and many other wasted opportunities. I never saw the girl again, but I made a pound, so I'd done well out of it. Now, this gave me another idea, because we still had no money coming through, and it was desperate. You see, you down to 1 and 6 months, 2 bob. I was all right with my pound. But some of the others, they could do nothing. And you no bank account, you no means of getting money without the field cashier. Now, outside one of these huts, there was a little Morris 8 two-seater. I remember it now. Yellow wheels, blue body, dark and black mudguards. Open tourer. And I was looking at this thing, wonder who owned it. And a sergeant came up to me, who was in a different draft and was getting money. And he said, could we borrow that? Well, I said, it'll cost you. I didn't say it was mine. He said, how much? I said, it'll cost you 10 bob. It was a lot of money for the evening. But I said, there's no petrol in it. It's not insured. It's not taxed. He said, don't worry, it's under me. Well, I said, put it back here when you're finished. So he took it off, and I'd never said I owned it, but anything to do with it. But I took the money, and every night thereafter, I was there, this thing was rented out. And I don't know whose it was. It belonged to some person who'd gone on a draft and abandoned it. The thing was probably only worth 10 or 15 pounds, and some people had 10 or 15 pounds, and I was rather pleased. But on the next draft, next boat to India, it was called the Athlone Castle, which we call the Alcantara after some prison ship with POWs going to Germany were rescued by the Navy earlier in the war. It was pretty terrible conditions in that boat. But I saw my man with the French letters. He now had half a dozen other people carrying them too. And I thought, how odd. All these half dozen other people could have done the same thing themselves, but they hadn't the initiative or the drive or take the risk. And we then landed at Bombay, and from Bombay the sea out from the town was yellow with sand and muck and so on. And there was a canteen of some sort on this ship, and there was things I'd never heard of called pretzel sticks, P-R-E-T-Z-E-L. American things, brisk, crisp sticks for cocktails. And he and I stood eating these things, looking at the awful sea, and you see Bombay and the Gateway of India, the big arch, 100 yards away. And we came into the docks, were allowed an afternoon off or something aboard, and we were wearing these ridiculous topies, solar topies, which had been withstand 1902, they were left over from the Boer War, which had been used, and they were dreadful things. When most people threw them into the sea, which again is a waste of public money, but they were useless. And we walked around Bombay rather aimlessly in the heat and the stench, and it's so different from South Africa, where everything was clean and fresh and pleasant. I know that it wasn't so fresh and pleasant for the people in the townships, but we knew nothing about that. And I remember seeing at the Bombay Yacht Club a Cord, an American Cord Roadster, which I fell in love with, and which after the war I bought. Was that not that one, but one like it, which I still have. I gave it to a character in one of my novels. I just liked the thing. We were then posted on to Belgaum in India, or Bangalore, and we were split up into two groups, and those several, we'd formed friendships of people. We'd like to have gone together. There was no question of that. You just told these people there, these people there. And Belgaum was a mass of small huts, not huts, houses, I suppose, and barracks, and we were in the barracks. and it was split up into rooms down below and upstairs and two floors. But the partitions didn't reach up to the roof. I suppose for coolness or whatever, they were about a foot less than the roof, and birds and things would fly in and out all the time. And I was in there with another chap who later became a master of foxhounds in Devon. Very nice chap. John Budget, Budgett. And our relaxation Saturday night was to go to the cinema. There was a thing called the Lion Cinema in Belgaum. And we'd walk down there and we'd hire a tonga to come back, a tonga, two-wheeled chariot thing with a horse, a wretched horse and a man. And we'd all race each other up, about 12 different tongas racing. And I often thought, looking back, how sad, really, we never thought of these poor horses who got no rest, just you work day and night, and while we just gave the chap a rupee tip if he won or didn't win or something. But when you're young, you don't always think about these things. And don't often think about almost anything, at least I didn't. And we had to learn Urdu, and you got 100 rupees, which is worth £7.10, £7.50, if you pass this exam. And it wasn't a difficult exam, because it was Urdu as propounded by a very clever brigadier, Brain, B-R-A-Y-N-E. And it was, what is the word for, not vocal, audio. Stop the machine a second. What is it? It was just phonetic Urdu, the Kier Hai, who is, sort of, and one couldn't write this down in all the curious script of the thing, but we didn't never had to. And we had a examination with an Indian soldier. We'd sit opposite him, and the examiner, we'd say, what village do you come from, what are you married, and all that sort of thing. And we passed that. We were then commissioned. The only thing of interest, well, happened in this place, this OTS at Belgaum, was that we were all called, an important announcement would be made one day, and we were all told to parade, when we were told that the first time that Indian cadets were going to come and join. And they really were very anglicized. They'd been to English-type schools in India. And we all got on extremely well. It was very pleasant. Just one second. Could you stop a second? We had to go from place to place in this camp, which is quite large, by bicycles. And we had a bicycle drill. We had to parade with our bicycles in two ranks and then turn to the right, then prepare to mount. Put your foot on the pedal, then mount, swing your leg over. And I was amazed how few people could ride a bike. And I also learned there, I was learning all the time, I certainly had a lot to learn, of the situation involving quartermasters. Now, they were old soldiers who, after years of service, were given the commission of a lieutenant. And they never, not a second lieutenant, a full lieutenant. They'd get no promotion. And they're in charge of the day-to-day running of the thing, the food, rations, and bicycle spares, and so on. Now, I was a duty cadet one day, and I had to leave a note for the quartermaster, who was a man about probably 45, with First World War ribbons on, and the Waziristan campaign with clasp and all that sort of thing, on ancient campaign medals. And I wrote the note that I had done in the local paper for the attention of Lieutenant Boggs. And he took me to the CO and said I had insulted him, his rank, and I wasn't fit to go forward as a cadet. And I appeared before the CO, who was a very serious offence, Liesl. Well, I said, sir, it's not meant in any insult, any way I knew of writing a note saying what I'd done, you see. He said, you should have written a note and said, I have the honour to be, sir, your obedient servant. Well, I said, sir, in future, I would do that, but I didn't realise. He said, well, this time we'll let you off, but otherwise we really thought you weren't fit to go forward. Now, in the other place in Bangalore, the other OTS, the quartermaster down there, he found that, at least I was told he found, that there was a considerable market in spares of bicycles in the bazaar, the local bazaar, where the Indians travel everywhere by bicycles, there are very few cars, and he would flog off bits and pieces of spares. And this came to the notice of his superiors, and this was a court-martial offence, of course, because he'd been doing it a long time, and he shot himself rather than go on. And I thought both those things are rather sad instances of people who had very not narrow views of life, but they thought they were, one thought he wasn't getting the respect due to him, and I was looking down on him, was quite absurd, and the other man thought others are getting more money than I am and I'll join them. And both of these are very difficult situations to overcome. To look out for imagined insults, or to put your hand in the till, is both unwise. We were eventually commissioned after a time in which, speaking of myself, I learned very little indeed. In fact, nothing. The standard of training was no better, if as good as what I'd learned in the depot at the Baths. Just simple thing, it was quite extraordinary, it's a total waste of time. We had to learn Morse code, which again was very difficult to do at any speed, and signalling by flags, and the basics of the motor car, motor transport. And we all had numbers on our chests on pieces of cardboard. I know I was 170. And I kept in touch with another one, Taffy Williams, a Welshman who was a Welsh bachelor, was a teacher up in Aberystwyth, and he was 182. And for years until he died, we'd send each other a Christmas card without our names, just our number on it. Best wishes from 182 or 170. Now, when we came to do for the final passing out, we had to pass the various tests, which are quite easy, except as far as I was concerned, the Morse code. I could do it slowly, but if you miss one set of dot, 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 dash, you're lost, your whole message is gone. And I knew I could never do this at the speed. Some people seem to pick it up very quickly, like some people can pick up shorthand quickly and others can't. But I could do the car business, there was nothing in that at all. And so I came to an arrangement with another cadet, Paul Scott, who later wrote The Jewel and the Crown, The Raj Quartet, and so on, and who afterwards became, for a time, my agent when I was a writer myself. Now, Paul Scott was not a mechanical mind, and I said, look, Paul, I can't do this Morse thing. You can't do the breakdown of the car. What we'll do with under different examiners who didn't know us, we'll switch the numbers, that's all. We're going by numbers, not name. So you do me, you're 170 to do the Morse code, and I'll do you for the car. And this was agreed. And, of course, the car was a 1,500 weight Chev truck or something, and it wouldn't start. Well, if you're interested in cars, it must start if it's got a mixture of petrol and a spark, and the engine is going round, and the spark meets the petrol, it must. Those things, you can't not make it start. So there's either that you're not getting a spark, or your petrol is not getting through, or the timing's not right. Well, the timing won't be altered for an exam like that. It's either a plug lead pulled out, or the lead, main lead from the distributor, or some obstruction in the petrol, and that's nothing. So Paul Scott and I pass with full marks on the car, and we passed with full marks on the Morse. I never thereafter ever had to use Morse code. I'm sure nobody ever did either, because not in our group. It was such a clumsy means of communication. Well, we had a week's leave, which I spent with another fellow in a hotel in Pune, because we'd always heard of Pune as a, in music hall jokes, I'm a Pune colonel, etc. And it was a very pleasant place indeed. And even in the church, though, we noticed that the fan blades of the fans in the ceiling were stamped Public Work Department, PWD. It was all owned by the military. We then were sent to Deolali Camp. Now, Deolali was down near Bombay. It was a British base reinforcement camp. It was on a plain ringed in by hills. The heat was colossal. And it had two distinctions, Deolali. One, it was the headquarters of the Royal Artillery, and secondly, it was the headquarters of the lunatic asylum of the British Army. A secure psychiatric unit, as they'd call it now, and there were real people there trying to, as we said, work their passage by claiming to be Napoleon or poached eggs ready to get back to England. The same class of person who had taken the sacks of French letters aboard. They didn't want to get involved in any fighting. The British base reinforcement camp was an unspeakable place, with rows and rows of tents, and the heat, they just burned. There was nothing much to do. And we hung about there until we were put on a train across India to Calcutta. Now, I think that took 3 or 5 days. It was enormous time. And the train would stop, of course, at stations, and you would telegraph ahead, or the officer in command of the train would, to the next station so that rations could be made for you. And often it stopped on hills, and that then the troops would get out with ration tins, which were big square sort of galvanized cans about 3 foot deep and about 18 inches across with a wooden bar as a handle, and they'd run with these things to the engine, and there was always someone who knew it had been an engine driver or something, and they'd drain off boiling water from the boiler and bring it back and make tea, you see, and they did so many things the engine couldn't go on, and you know, quite extraordinary. And we finally, we were lucky, I remember there were 4 or 5 of us in a compartment, again with a little lavatory, rather like the Britannic troop ship, and a shower, and we sat with no air conditioning, there was a fan. We sat with the doors open and your feet out, watching the country go by. It was very, quite pleasant. Came to Calcutta, and we were drafted onto the docks, I suppose we marched there, I can't remember now, and to a ship called SS El Medina, El Medina after Medina, Mecca, one of the great holy places of the Muslims. And I remember an Indian officer there, he was very proud of being in Calcutta, he'd never been there before, and he said something you wouldn't hear now. He said, "This is the second city in the whole British Empire. It's a shame we have no more time to spend looking at it." So we got aboard this ship, and I was the second lieutenant, just 20. I was in a tiny cabin with another second lieutenant, he had the top bunk, I had the bottom, and we had with us all our belongings in huge black black metal trunk. And we had to buy such ridiculous things in Belgaum as a great coat for the winter, and service dress with buttons, which we had to pay for ourselves, bought from what was called an officer's shop in those days. You had to buy this stuff, which was useless, going to Burma in the heat. And